I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Thanks for joining us for the ongoing quest for the awe and the wonder that await each of us every day and all around. Awe can be found in all creation, human or wild, vast or small, in spiritual encounters that move us beyond words. If you love something a whole lot, you can put a suffix on it. We've all met bookworms or bibliophiles, movie buffs or cinephiles. Maybe you know a few francophiles who take vacation after vacation to Paris or the French Riviera. And even though arachnophobia is the far more common human condition, at least in theory, it's possible to have arachnophilia. In this episode of Constant Wonder, we're going to meet somebody who can fairly be called topophilic. Topophilia has been described as a readiness to be astonished by place, topos being Greek for place, and of course, philia is Greek for love. But what if you loved a place so much that you decided to torch it, incinerate it, burn it right down to the ground?
The burn was hugely important, and the day that it happened, I had been waiting for the burn for 18 months, and it felt like it was never going to happen. It felt to me like everything hinged on it.
Paula Wyman has what can only be described as love for the place she had burned. She's author of Bad Naturalist, One Woman's Ecological Education on a Wild Virginia Mountaintop. Her overall motive was nature conservation, supporting and restoring native species. And while it may seem counterintuitive, controlled burning is a powerful tool, among many others, in the conservation kit. Standing with her husband and one of their children on that wild mountaintop situated near the Blue Ridge subrange of the Appalachians, Paula watched as skilled professionals got going with a prescribed burn. The crew was at long last available in a window when the season and the weather were right.
There were two burns that day, and for the first burn, they made me stand pretty far away. I was probably about a quarter mile across the meadow. I could see the whole hillside where the firefighters were gathering in a wide circle. They had bulldozed a fire line all around this few acres where they were planning to burn. And then they stood at the boundary and lit from the edges with their drip torches and then start walking in toward the middle. And as they're walking in, you see the fire consuming this area that they had marked off. Really didn't take that long for smoke to fill that area so that the whole field looked like it had disappeared in a cloud of smoke.
When the smoke cleared, a giant black patch remained, surrounded by the original rusty orange vegetation, typical of the meadow in late winter. It was still weeks before the greening of spring. Wildfire management by controlled burning is, of course, a classic scenario of method in the madness. Yet what Paula Wyman was undertaking on her couple hundred acres was only tangentially about wildfire prevention. As I visited with her about her ecological education on this mountaintop, our conversation wove back and forth in a tapestry of colors, all tied up with the environmental health of this particular piece of land that she has come to love. Only one strand of that tapestry, as you'll hear, was ash black. But before we survey her full scheme of rewilding or restoration of this land, let's stick for a little while yet with the specifics of the burn. I wanted to know about the fire crew.
7 or 8 folks, some of whom were volunteers, some of whom were rescue squad workers, some were firefighters. The burn boss, who is a forester with the Virginia Department of Forestry, cut most of the fire lines with a bulldozer, which meant, in one case, going down a very steep slope with that bulldozer. He also monitored the humidity, the temperature, the wind speed constantly, because we're talking about this mountaintop is a highly erodible, dry, rocky place. And it's very important, obviously, that the fire not get out of hand.
The region had recently seen drought. Trees, shrubs, thatch, forbs, and brambles were especially dry. Every precaution needed to be taken, even though it was still winter.
Luckily, it all went smoothly until, on the steep slope that they were burning, there was an invasive vine climbing up a snag at the edge of a forest. This snag, this dead tree, may have been a poplar, caught fire. And they ended up having to cut out a piece of fence, knock down this tree, which was probably 60 feet tall. They were still there after dark, working on it, just on this snag, so that it wouldn't catch the rest of the forest. And that happened even though they had cut such a deep fire line that they had literally turned sod over. And there was literally 8 feet of dirt between the field they were burning and the forest.
Everybody has a little bit of a pyro in them, just a tiny little bit of a, and I'm wondering if did it make your heart race at all? Did you kind of swallow a little bit just to see what was happening?
Oh, it was very exciting. In fact, the second burn that they did, for some reason, they didn't make me stand as far away. So I got very close. My eyes were watering, and you could smell the smoke and the fire in the air. I was close enough that when a flame jumped up 15 feet in the air, which is kind of unusual for a low heat winter burn, I stepped back, just sort of automatically thinking, oh, am I too close? I don't know.
Yeah. So obviously, everything you have described is a classic controlled burn. We're living in an age with devastating cataclysmic fires. A controlled burn is a completely different atmosphere. And so you're able to say that watching this happen filled you with an elation. You say you were elated. And that has to do with the reasons for burning this meadow. Was there a kind of a festive vibe going on for you and your family watching this?
Absolutely. It was thrilling and exciting that such an important step was finally happening, that was really happening. We had had false starts before during that year and a half when we were waiting. And at some point, it was kind of like a kid thinking they'll never go to Disneyland. I really thought, this may never happen. So when it did happen, it was such a relief and a real milestone. My goal was to bring back native plants to the meadow. The meadow, when I came upon it, was a mixture of hay grasses, fescues, which are non-native grasses, and invasive plants, lots of invasive plants. The reason I wanted to tip the balance toward native plants in the meadow was to create habitat for native wildlife that was otherwise losing habitat for birds that were in decline. Grassland birds are in severe decline. Pollinators, butterflies, bees that are in decline. Native plants, wildlife, and insects support each other. They evolved together over millions of years, and they feed each other. So to maintain that balance, I needed to encourage the growth of native plants, and fire would do that. Because native plants in Virginia and in lots of places are fire adapted, meaning they evolved in the presence of fire. They need periodic burning in order to grow and reproduce more successfully. They'll produce more seeds, more fruit. They'll grow more quickly. They'll be healthier if they're periodically burned. And for the non-native plants here, that is mostly not the case. Burning mostly does not give them an advantage.
So the big irony here is that you're sounding very much like an expert, a naturalist, somebody who is schooled in all of this, and yet you've got this book out called Bad Naturalist. So who is Paula Wyman to be able to be involved in any of this?
Well, when I started out, I really didn't know very much about plants at all. I came to this from a longtime passion for nature and wildlife and ecology. I was a kid who would let cicadas crawl on my arms and legs. I would dig holes looking for ants. I would follow bees with a magnifying glass. And I would go into these deep dives throughout my life on different creatures, lizards, carpenter bees, where I had to find out everything I could possibly know about them. Horseshoe crabs or mangroves. I would find a horseshoe crab washed up on the beach, and I was sure it was supposed to be in the water. So I'd throw it back. I'd find it on the beach again. I'd throw it back. And then finally, I thought, well, something's wrong, so it needs my help. So I would take it back to wherever we were staying and put it in the bathtub and sprinkle a little salt in there, hoping that that would mimic the ocean. This didn't usually work out, but my parents were tolerant. So this is all, you know, even as an adult, I know to leave fledglings when you see them on the ground, but one day I was watching a robin in my driveway, a robin fledgling, and it was just not doing well. It was very hot, and finally it keeled over, and I went and put it in a shoebox, and I drove it to an animal rescue place, but when I got there, it was already dead.
Bad naturalist there, maybe?
I've had many attempts but limited success over the years at saving things. And why I thought I could save this meadow, I don't know. My original plan was to plant a small native meadow wherever we ended up. And instead, I ended up with this 200-acre place where so much more was possible. So am I a bad naturalist? Was I a bad naturalist in the sense that I really had a lot to learn? I was looking for somebody to come and tell me, here's what you do, 1, 2, 3, and then you'll have your native meadow, and it will stay there forever and ever. The more I spoke with experts, the more I realized there wasn't one right answer. And whatever I do, there are trade-offs. I help one thing and risk hurting another thing. So that made me feel like a bad naturalist. I spent a lot of time being confused. Depending on who I spoke with and what their particular orientation was, they might have different ideas about it. Mow, no, don't mow. Mow this time, no, mow that time. Burn this time, no, burn that time. No, use pesticides. You have to spray these. No, don't spray those. And it was a lot to absorb. But eventually, it all sort of settled down in my mind, and I was able to see through it to the approach that was comfortable for me.
How disheartening is it to have that awareness wash over you that you're on your own because the experts are disagreeing? I mean, is that a kick to the gut?
You know, I guess I didn't see it that way. I was so appreciative of everyone's time, and people were so willing to come out and walk the land with me and teach me. I felt like I got a crash course in ecology, and none of them were wrong in what they told me. It was just, the question was, given what I wanted to do and how I felt about, say, pesticides, what was the right approach for me? So it was important for me to have all that input. And it was extremely confusing for me also.
It's unlikely that either you or I will ever have full charge over reinvigorating or rewilding 200 acres of land, whether it be near the Blue Ridge Mountains or anywhere else. So by now, you're likely wondering, how did Paula get into this pickle in the first place, this weighty responsibility for woodland and a big, big meadow? Certainly a pickle, but also a grand adventure?
My husband and I had been looking for many years for a place in the country. The idea was a small farmhouse with a small piece of land where I could have a few sheep. And when I say a few, maybe 3 or 4, very few, where I would plant this native meadow And I would have my writing shed next to the meadow, and I'd watch the birds and bees flying around, and it was all very romanticized in my mind, idealistic, delusional. Then one day, we were in Rappahannock County, which is where we were focusing our search, and someone said, oh, you have to go up and see the view while you're here. You have to go up to this mountain and see the view. So we thought, okay, sure.
Piedmont is a word derived from Italian, meaning at the foot of the mountain. The Appalachian Piedmont is an upland region or a plateau stretching from Alabama to New York. In Virginia, it's tucked in between the Blue Ridge Mountains to the west and the Atlantic coastal plain to the east. The piece of sparsely populated rural land with a great view, the one that somebody had recommended that Paula Wyman and her husband stop to see, was situated on a Piedmont prominence across a valley from Shenandoah National Park in Virginia.
It was August. The sun was beating down. This place had been a cattle farm for decades, and before that, an apple orchard for more than 100 years. You could see for miles from this place that wasn't even that high. It was more the position. It was about 1,400 feet. And looking out at that meadow, which turned out to be 75 or 80 acres, I thought, well, my plan to plant a native meadow of maybe an acre or two sounds very unambitious to me right now.
On that first visit, Paula and her husband realized they were surveying a location that had been sorely neglected.
It had been a while since anything had been happening there. It had gone to seed. The road was not maintained, and it was more like a trail. So we hiked up to the meadow, and there was a path mowed through all the vegetation because, as I say, nothing had been happening there in a while, except the plants had continued to grow. It was jungle-like vegetation. The plants were over our heads, dense, green, and at that time in August, it was full of these yellow flowers that were over 6 feet high. So we were walking along this path that was just wide enough for, you know, two or three people. And we got up to the high point, and I looked out, and below me, there were rolling hills, open meadow, surrounded by steep forested slopes, oak hickory forest. And beyond that meadow, you could see the Blue Ridge silhouetted. It was quite a spectacle.
You painted a picture of somebody who wanted a soft light on a nice little cottage for riding in with some frolicking sheep and a very bucolic sort of romanticized thing. You actually ended up in a place with nasty stuff like snakes, ticks, thorns. Who? I guess I really mean to say why. Why would anybody get all tangled up in a daunting project to take on terrain like this, to do whatever it is that a naturalist, good or bad, might want to accomplish in an ecosystem like this that's been all neglected, left to run amok?
I felt like this place needs me. Maybe that's a consequence of the stage of life where I was at that moment. My kids are in their 20s, and suddenly this whole part of my brain that used to be used for logistics and planning when you have kids in school and so on was freed up, and I could have kept just writing, doing whatever else I was doing. But I felt a need to use that part of my brain for something special, that new energy that I had for something that seemed important.
What did you have to tackle there that was so wrong?
Well, I never knew that trees could be bad, that there were invasive trees. So the tree of heaven, the autumn olive, something called the Polonia or princess tree, they drop millions of seeds. They're sort of a blight on the landscape, and they tend to take over. The autumn olive is a shrub that forms thickets. Multiflora rose has these huge thorns, and it's really hard to cut. It's very dense. Mile a minute vine, which grows 6 inches a day and smothers everything. Japanese honeysuckle with snakes through the field and up trees and strangles tree trunks. Japanese stilt grass, which on my land grows 3 or 4 feet tall and smothers plants, hides plants, takes over the forest floor. And then you've got deer. We have a lot of deer. They are rampant because there are no predators. People think coyotes eat deer. They don't. Bears don't eat deer. They might take a fawn, but they're not going to take an adult deer. So we have way too many deer, and they eat all the native plants. They trample and eat the understory, and they allow things like Japanese stilt grass and garlic mustard to get into the understory and prevent the trees that we want, like oaks, from growing into seedlings and maturing into trees.
Soon after acquiring the property, Paula wandered through the meadow with a forester who advised conducting the battle of ecological restoration on two fronts. First, minimizing the presence of invasive plants, and second, minimizing the presence of deer. Now, if you happen to have a tender heart, just how can you justify that?
Well, I'm from one of the many Bambi generations, you know. I was scarred by that film. I think deer are adorable, and I don't like killing anything. I don't even like killing a beetle. So it was hard, but the reality is that the deer are so overpopulated that they don't have enough food. They get sick. They have this chronic wasting disease, which is horrible, and they suffer. If we still had wolves and mountain lions, we wouldn't have so many deer. But since we don't, people have to take the place of the wolves and the mountain lions to some degree.
Paula may or may not remember this little cinematic detail. In the movie Bambi, the humans are never shown. Gunshots ring out, unmistakably villainizing the humans as hunters. You're never really allowed to wonder if they're actually wildlife managers working in the interest of ecosystem conservation. Now, that's not the thing, is it? Now, that would have been a radically different take on Disney's part. We've got to understand the concept of rewilding. Can you walk us through that? Because places change, and it's hard to go back and say you can never put things back the way they were, and I put the "were" in quotation marks.
Yeah, ecological restoration is a term that's used a lot. Rewilding, I think, is maybe used more in Europe and the UK. Rewilding, to me, also involves animals. For instance, Isabella Tree, whose book Wilding was a big inspiration for me, she allowed her 3,000-plus acre farm in Sussex to go back to nature, and she introduced animals that would mimic the behavior of animals that once lived there but that weren't available anymore, native animals. And so she introduced animals to take their place. In ecological restoration, you might or might not use animals as proxies for those earlier animals. Like bison and elk would have lived on the mountain many years ago, but they were, you know, wiped out from Virginia. And actually, the elk are being reintroduced in the western part of Virginia right now. But when I looked into animals, it really wasn't going to be practical to introduce bison in a place where I still wanted to be able to walk around. They're not known for their friendliness. And so I was looking at it more from a quote-unquote restoration perspective, tipping the balance to native plants. But as you implied, the word restoration implies going back to something. And there is no going back. There is only going forward. We can only work with what we have to work with now. 50, 100 years ago, we didn't have all of these invasive plants crowding in any disturbed area. And, you know, that even though some of those plants came in hundreds of years ago, some of them didn't get out of hand until recently. And if you just leave a place alone, they'll take over, and that there goes your native plants and wildlife. So it's really about finding the right balance between non-native and native plants and minimizing the invasive plants as much as possible.
You mentioned your learning process and your confusion in your efforts to become a better-than-bad naturalist. At length, when you started to have a vision settle into place and some of that confusion dissipated, what kinds of treatments, what kinds of solutions, I mean, apart from the controlled burning, what did you undertake that seemed effective in working towards this balance that you describe?
Well, I did a combination of mowing, bush hogging, and forestry mulching. And bush hogging and forestry mulching are sort of like mowing on steroids. You can use them to deal with larger, denser vegetation. Forestry mulching is almost what it sounds like. Everything is shredded. Whereas bush hogging, everything is cut to whatever height you specify. So a combination of mowing to prevent areas from becoming forest, which I know some people are like, why would you want to prevent that, which I can talk about. And I wanted to really minimize the use of pesticides because I think they're dangerous to so many species. And so we only use them very minimally, spot treating plants like a mile a minute vine when it came up, spot treating invasive trees like tree of heaven, because you can treat a tree directly and not affect the plants or animals around it.
So one of the things I've learned from Paula is that a bush hog is not a feral pig. It's good to know. And one of the things that I admire so much about Paula's restoration work on this meadow is that she has always been very much hands-on. Some of the work, yes, does get contracted out, but specialists in this line of work are in high demand. They're just not always available when you need them. So, given this labor shortage, she rolls up her sleeves and digs in. Actually, she seems hardly averse to it in the first place. But imagine trying to weed a giant meadow, 75 acres of it, on your own. You would be there until the cows come home. And we're talking about cows that left this former farm decades ago.
I can't possibly keep up with all of it. I have this 15-pound weed wrench that's as tall as me that I lug around in the meadow looking for seedlings and small saplings that are bad, especially after a rain when the ground is wet, and then I can pull them. I pull them up with this wrench that wraps around the base of the tree, and then you lean on it like a lever, and it will pull it out of the ground after some effort. Just recently, I discovered a hillside of Jimson weed, which is an invasive plant that has a seed pod that sort of pops. It looks spiky on the outside, and some days it'll just pop and send seeds everywhere. So I was trying to prevent that, but I needed to wait for the ground to be wet so I could pull them up more easily. I ended up pulling this whole hillside, and I filled two, like, 35-gallon contractor bags with these seedlings, and then I couldn't move the bags. They were too heavy. So I ended up leaving them on the hillside to solarize, and I'll move them when the plants inside are sufficiently dead that they're not as heavy.
Well, what is your state of mind as you're doing this work? Is there anything zen-like about it, or is it just rage?
It depends. Like, when I went back to that hillside and I was like, oh, I missed one, you know, weeks later, I'd rush right out there and pull them up. It's a combination. I was like, no, you're not going to. When I see, like, stilt grass in a new place, I have to get to it. But then I have to wait till August because you have to pull these things at the right time. If you pull stilt grass too early, it's just going to grow back. So all of that is really important. But some of it is meditative. And sometimes a sort of obsessiveness. I mean, there's definitely a certain obsessiveness to my personality. Maybe I have to be like that in order to do this work because, like, I will spend an entire day in late August when you can pull the stilt grass on this one patch where I'm It was like, I remember it was like 95 degrees. I was sweating through my clothes and I was wearing long sleeves and long pants because of the ticks. And it was this cathartic experience when I got it all up and behind it, I discovered all this goldenrod. Well, sadly, I came back later to also discover a bunch of garlic mustard in the same place. So that's the next thing I'll have to tackle in that spot. But at least I got that one thing. And yes, it's going to come back probably 7 more years. I'll have to keep doing it in the dead of August, sweating through my clothes. But I'm willing to do that.
Yeah. So was Sisyphus.
The boulder gets a little smaller each time.
Paula Wyman is author of Bad Naturalist, One Woman's Ecological Education on a Wild Virginia Mountaintop. Ahead of us in this episode, Paula's going to share with us a stunning ecological revelation that came her way when she found out that by targeting what she thought to be a tiny pest, a destructive nuisance of a spider, actually, it was a certain tree mite, an arachnid, she could easily have killed off a whole community of interdependent organisms, including the very native tree species she was intending to rescue. I'm Marcus Smith, and you're listening to Constant Wonder. You said that you had this feeling that this place needs me. There are a lot of places that need us, lots of places that need us. And yet, is it just any place that needs you, or was it this place that needed you? I'm just wondering about how quickly you felt like you had a relationship to a particular place.
Well, my first feeling was being completely overwhelmed by what I was looking at. Acres and acres of yellow flowers, these rolling hills. I had no experience with land. I had never aspired to own land. When we were looking around, I was more focused on the utilitarian part of it, the farmhouse where we would live, the sheep that I would raise, the vegetable garden that I would plant, the meadow that would attract bees. I wasn't thinking about it from that other perspective. So looking out at this vast place and thinking of taking it on, I'm not sure I can explain why in that moment I thought, oh, this is what I'm meant to do, learning all about this mountain and what's living here and what it needs. And I didn't even know in that moment what it might need, but I knew that it had been let go and that from an ecological perspective, it probably needed help because of that.
You just made mention a moment ago about the concept of ownership and that you had never really thought about owning land. In fact, I'm going to quote you here in the book you've written. Do I own the soil and the rocks and the mosses, the toads by the pond, the dung beetle too? I can't quite get my mind around it. And then later in the book, again, you reiterate this. Do I own the lichens that are attached to the rocks that are embedded in the earth? Let's play with this ownership notion just a little bit more. Because to feel that a place needs you is kind of the reverse of ownership.
No, it didn't feel like ownership. It felt like partnership. The more I learned about what lived there, what could be done there, what could be improved, what creatures and plants I could encourage, the more connected I felt with the place in a way that I had never felt connected with land before, maybe since I was a little kid, when I probably felt very proprietary about the yard where I would dig holes and collect bugs. But, and it's not a proprietary sense. It was more like, I'm actually part of this, and my impact here is more than what I overtly set out to do. But also its impact on me is something that I didn't necessarily expect or anticipate.
Paula is wise to the truth that fostering a diversity of life forms in a vibrant ecosystem is perpetual, unending. "Nothing that is can pause or stay," wrote Longfellow. "The moon will wax, the moon will wane, the mist and cloud will turn to rain, the rain to mist and cloud again." Nature morphs and shifts and evolves. But what can be accomplished by human hand in the foreseeable future? Paula says she's hoping to fill 75% of the meadow's total area with native plants. At present, native plants come in below 50%. Can achieving this ambition substantially change the character of these 200 acres? And will the boulder of Sisyphus really get smaller with time? And frankly, what window of time, the kind of time we experience as humans on a small scale, really even matters in the long term?
This meadow was likely a savanna, so a grassland punctuated by occasional trees, for many, many years before it became an apple orchard. A scientist who studies grasslands told me that the way our meadow was situated, the number of rock outcroppings, the types of trees, the types of plants he was seeing, told him that at some point this had been savanna, and it wasn't all necessarily closed canopy, dense forest.
I'm going to insert something here that will help with our understanding of savanna. Before the arrival of European settlers, the North American landscape included extensive prairie or grassland, and then this vegetative mix called savanna. As it happens, many of the southern states were once replete with grassland, including the Piedmont region's grassy woodlands, or woody grasslands, if you will. There's no written record of any of this, by the way. But the fossil record bears out a prehistory of extensive prairie and savanna throughout much of the South, remarkably biodiverse habitats. And whenever heavy forests began to encroach on these more open areas, this incremental ecological succession choking out the sun was routinely thwarted, disrupted by lightning-induced wildfires. Also, there were indigenous peoples who kept forestation in check, and they did it with intentional burns. And after that, European farming practices entered the picture. And this style of agriculture included plowing, and the plowing buries the native seed bank that once lay atop the soil. All of this in exchange for bringing in old-world crops with their non-native seeds. In the process, whole communities of codependent native species were often obliterated. The whole shooting match. Animals, plants, insects. Well, why am I telling you all of this? Well, it's because Paula's low montane acreage is a prime example of how savanna disappeared. It's too tempting for us to assume that prehistoric ecosystems are simply going to revive on their own. There's a big problem with this expectation, and it's that with the disappearance of the native seed bank along with co-evolved species, well, it's just been too drastic. What's gone missing? Well, microorganisms in the soil, fungus, native grasses, forbs, shrubs, tree types, and the whole assortment of wild animal species. Basically, every living system you can even imagine can suffer a setback so extreme that spontaneous regeneration is no longer possible. This is what Paula was hinting at when she was talking about the eradication of bison and other large fauna. And yet it's still very, very common for us to idealize that beautiful image of a closed canopy forest at the very tail end of a biological succession. That kind of a forest just isn't resilient like a landscape with a rich diversity of plants.
So now if you ask people who grew up in these places, who lived there a long time ago, they would say, oh, that's supposed to be forest. But really, it's a lot of times it's not true.
You know, as much as I'd like to just take your word for it that you've been making some important inroads, that might be the wrong metaphor. You know what I mean. I do know that you have had some welcome validation from some experts. I could call them the good naturalists, maybe. Third-party observers, outside auditors, if you will. There is an organization called the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute. And inside that organization is an entity called Virginia Working Landscapes. These are people who gather a whole lot of data about conservation on private lands like yours, and they have been able to see, I'm happy to report, measurable progress where you've been working, successes. And strangely enough, sometimes these are successes that you haven't quite even seen clearly yourself.
They came out and did a plant and bird survey 4 years ago. So I had sort of a baseline understanding of some of the more dominant plants and birds in the meadow. Recently, the person who did the bird survey came back to the mountain. She had not been there for 3 years. And she looked around and said, "Oh my goodness, I can see a big difference." That made me feel so good because, you know, when you see a place every day, you don't necessarily notice the change. But after 3 years of not being here, she noticed a marked difference. So I felt like that was outside validation that that is really good to have, especially when there's so many obstacles and things that can go wrong.
As you go about intervention, culling of the deer herd and pulling of the weeds, all of this work, there is a rational aspect to it where I understand the need to do this. You're rescuing a meadow. You're bringing back pollinators. You're supporting the bird populations. It all makes sense to me. And yet, for us to experience awe and wonder, we got to let go of some things and kind of just be present to observe them. So do you, amid all this work, do you have that awe and wonder? Where does your heart go when you're just alone in the meadow and you put that weeding tool down?
One of my favorite parts of this project is just wandering very slowly, stopping and looking at plants, at insects, and making discoveries. One day I came upon this black cherry tree, which is a wild cherry tree. We have lots of those on the mountain, and they're actually very good. They support hundreds, more than 400 species of pollinator. So I saw these, they're called galls, growing on the leaves of this tree. A gall is formed when an insect lays its egg on the leaf, and the leaf reacts by forming this odd structure. It can be many different shapes, but in this case, it was shaped like a little worm that was standing up on top of the leaf. So I thought, oh, some horrible insect is attacking this tree. I have to figure out what it is. I might have to do something about it. What can I do? Well, which is kind of ridiculous because I probably have thousands of those black cherry trees. Am I going to do something about every single one? But what I found out was that there was a mite that laid its egg on the leaf, and its larva developed inside that gall. So that was a gall. It wasn't an insect. It was a shell around the larva. And I learned that there's a carnivorous caterpillar, the larva of a butterfly. This caterpillar eats that gall. It eats the mite and the larva, whatever's inside it. And therefore protects the tree from dying as a result of these mites. And there's an ant that protects the caterpillar from a wasp that would attack it because the ant likes to drink this nectar secreted by the caterpillar. It comes to the tree for nectar secreted by the tree, but it also likes this caterpillar nectar. A lot of insects produce something called honeydew. That's really what it's called, is honeydew. So the ant protects the caterpillar from the wasp. Now, if I hadn't learned about any of that and I just thought, oh, I should spray this tree to get rid of whatever that finger-shaped thing is on the leaves, I would have killed everything except for the mite inside that gall. I would have killed the whole balance of creatures that was keeping that tree alive, that in turn served all those hundreds of pollinator species that also would help pollinate the tree and keep the tree alive. If it was going to be damaged by this one insect, what about those other 400 species? So things like that are just thrilling to me to learn. So I'm always wandering through the meadow looking for those relationships so that I can figure out what's happening there. And I am figuring it out as I go along, and I'm 59 years old. It's nice to know that I can take on something like this. It's totally new to me.
We launched into this episode with the word topophilia, love of a place. And you may remember that I also threw in the word arachnophilia, which apparently Paula Wyman has also acquired, now that she's been able to set aside her misunderstanding of mites. She's author of Bad Naturalist, One Woman's Ecological Education on a Wild Virginia Mountaintop. Nowadays, she resides about 90% of the time in a new home built right on this land. That was always part of her dream. She had hoped to live there, even before she owned up to what it would really take to care for a complex place like this. In just a moment here on Constant Wonder, we're going to round out this profile of Paula Wyman with some of her insights into our human place in this indescribably complex, wondrous world that we get to inhabit wherever we are. I'm Marcus Smith. There's another podcast you might like from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called In Good Faith. Stephen Cap Perry is the host. He visits with people of various faith traditions. These guests are generous and compassionate and share in their own words firsthand experiences of their faith, hope, and belief. It's a chance to deepen our collective understanding of what it's like to live a spiritual life. And by the way, Stephen has a global perspective. He has cultivated that over a lifetime of travel, and that enlivens every conversation he has. In Good Faith, an inspiring journey. Be sure to listen wherever you get your podcasts. We now return to Constant Wonder. Place and time. Those are the two overarching coordinates of our life. And I sense that you've come to love this place. What has this chapter of your life done to your experience or perception of time?
I definitely lose track of time when I'm in the meadow. It makes me think about how close I am with the rest of the natural world and how we tend to set ourselves aside from it. We build edifices around ourselves. We're very good at putting shields up, feeling as if we're separate from nature when we actually are nature. Being in the meadow, being in the woods, even just looking out the window and watching the juncos pick seeds out of the ragweed plants in front of my house makes me feel like I'm more connected with everything. And I know that I'm just a blip on the screen of the whole natural cycle. What I'm trying to do is almost nothing when you look at the timeline of the planet. Maybe in 100 years or 400 years, someone will find out that everything I did was wrong. But for now, if I can make change in this place and somehow make this place a little bit better, I've done my part, I guess, as a part of the natural world.
When you first began this project, there was no home there for you. And now you're actually living there in that home. On that site, I think I'm speaking with you while you're probably situated right there. Is that so?
Yes.
Yeah. Is it home?
It is home. It is home. We really changed our goals when we were standing on that mountain for the first time and looking out at the meadow. There was no house. For the first 3+ years, I was driving back and forth from my home in the suburbs, going home at the end of the day exhausted and dirty and full of mud, 4,000 seeds stuck to me with scratches from thorns, with my shirt and pants shredded from bramble.
No snake bites yet?
No snake bites. No, I actually see many more black snakes than rattlesnakes. I've heard the rattlesnakes, but I don't tend to see them.
Well, Paula, I would love to hear you share one last story in conclusion, something that might be symbolic of where you have been while you were pursuing this quest, if I can call it that, because you're obviously so full of purpose and personal dedication to a place that, frankly, you have come to love. Could you pick and maybe relive for us an experience that kind of tells you that this has all been worth it?
There's a rock at one end of the meadow that we call Dominion Rock. It's a large outcropping, taller than I am. And I'd been told at some point that there were about 30 different species of lichen on this boulder. So I was busy examining these lichens. It was a spring day. The meadow was green, but there wasn't a lot that was flowering yet. Things were just starting to get tall again. And I looked up, and there was a bird hovering above this boulder, just maybe at about 12 feet, 13 feet of height. And it was almost stationary. The tips of its wings were fluttering, as if that was what it was doing to keep itself in that one spot. And that may have been what it was doing. And then it dove, and it dove down behind the rock. So I couldn't see it after that, but it was the most amazing thing. And it was an American kestrel. An American kestrel is a small raptor that's in decline in this area. And it's been the subject of a lot of research to try to figure out why it's in decline. So what I saw was hunting behavior. The kestrel does this thing where it hovers and it flutters the tips of its wings, and then it dives down at its prey, which might have been a vole, because there are thousands of voles in the meadow. The vole is a small rodent about the size of a mouse. And in that moment, I thought, okay, I'm doing something right. I'd never seen a kestrel there before. It was one of my goals to bring back these meadow birds. And knowing that it was a bird that was in decline and seeing it there was just the absolute best feeling.
The writer Paula Wyman is author of Bad Naturalist, One Woman's Ecological Education on a Wild Virginia Mountaintop. This episode of Constant Wonder was produced by me with assistance from Tenery Taylor and Brian Barba. Sound design was by James Call. We'd love to hear from you about your experience with Constant Wonder, the podcast, and even just your own personal experience of firsthand, transcendent, meaningful, constant wonder and awe. Just email us your stories anytime at constantwonder@byu.edu. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.